This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their five-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Pennsylvania Woodsman, powered by Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network.
This show is driven to provide relatable hunting and outdoor content in the Keystone State and surrounding Northeast.
On this show, you'll hear an array of perspectives from biologists and industry professionals
to average Joes with a lifetime of knowledge.
All centered around values aiming to be better outdoorsmen and women,
both in the field as well as home and daily life.
No clicks, no self-interest, just delight in the pursuit of creation.
And now, your host, the man who's too good to stop for a roadkill deer to check it out, Mitchell Shirk.
Hey everybody, welcome back to this week's episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. Thanks for joining us, guys. I'm excited to bring you the content we got coming up here, not only this week, but for the next couple weeks. So we are leading into spring gobbler season. You know, this Saturday is the youth hunt. So good luck to anybody who's taking out any kids, anybody who's, you know, doing some scouting, getting ready for opening day of the season. You know, best of luck to you. But I'm excited. Turkey season is just a narrow, short window of the year where I shift focus off of the thing that I love the most, and that's chasing, you know, some of our big game species in the fall. And I don't think about turkeys year round. I don't get bird brain, but for just a short period of time. But I'm starting to get there. I've been seeing some turkeys driving around, scouting around. I've been hearing birds, and I'm getting excited now. I'm slowly starting to get there. I think this year, I think I've got it lined up. I'm going to continue my quest to try to finish the shotgun slam. While I can't finish it this year, I'm going to try to notch a couple more birds on these different guns. So I've acquired a 10-gauge, and I'm going to try to find some loads for it and take this 10-gauge out turkey hunting this year. I'm at the halfway point. I've got the 12, the 20, and the 28-gauge. So I'm going to try to shoot one with the 10-gauge. And we'll see. Maybe I'll take the 16 gauge back out. There's going to be one little caveat to that, and that's going to be if I'm able to go up to the piece of public land that I killed my bear and my buck on this year. One of the cool things I did was about a half a mile apart from each other, I was able to fill both of my, you know, big game tags this past fall, and I thought, man, it would be really cool if I can get up there and fill the triple trophy on that same piece of public land in one season. So we're going to try. I just don't know if the stars are going to align for me to get up and hunt there that much. But if I do go there, I might skip out on the shotgun slam. I might take, you know, the big tried and true boomstick where I can reach out and touch one at 50 yards if I need to, and that would be either my 12 gauge or my 20 gauge with TSS. So I might skip out on that, but I think it'd be pretty cool to get a turkey up there. I'm going to try if we can get my schedule to align. But anyway, I'm excited for turkey season. We got a lot of turkey hunting content coming up. We're going to take a new approach. So starting on next week's episode, you know, our episodes drop every Wednesday. We are going to start launching episodes with guys that are experienced turkey hunters, and the approach is going to be, how are you handling the next 7 days of turkey season? So, you know, next week will be the Wednesday before the season opener. We're going to talk about the opening day into the first week. And then that episode's going to drop the following week. And we're going to talk about that Wednesday into week two and so on and so forth. And just pick people's brains on how do you handle this week of the season, beginning, mid, late season. Some of them we pre-recorded. Some of them we're going to record as we go. And I think it's going to be fun. It's going to probably keep things a little bit exciting, edge of your seat. And I brought some new people onto the show that I think you guys will enjoy the content that they have to bring. A lot of fun conversations have occurred from this turkey hunting series, I guess we're going to call it, a 4 to 5 week series leading through the season. So I'm excited. But the last episode before we get into turkey content is going to be with my friend Chris Romano. So I recorded this episode back with Chris for a while. God bless him. I was in a pinch and I needed some content, and I threw an Instagram story out there if anybody wanted to record, and I was blessed with a lot of the people that you've heard the past few weeks responding and saying how they'd love to come on the show. Chris was the first one to respond to me, and I had every intention of putting him as the first episode. But this episode, like it normally does with Chris is super hyper-focused to detail. And we talked about a lot of good stuff, and he encouraged me to say, look, I really think you should do a part two to this episode because it goes hand in hand with what we talked about. So because of that, I kicked this episode down the road and decided I'm going to launch it this week. And then the first episode that we're going to have following the turkey season content is going to be an episode with Chris. And I'm looking forward to having part two with him. We still haven't recorded part two, so I'm going to have to listen back to this one and make sure we're on par for that one. But this week, Chris is a mad scientist when it comes to his hyper-focused detail of arrow flight. And he is taking things to a level I have never even heard anybody take it to, and is really doing his darndest to bring the content of the truth behind arrow flight and arrow science to people who want to listen and people who want to get better as a bow hunter and encourage their archery ability to go to the next level. And this is a pretty well-rounded conversation, and again, I feel like we just scratched the surface of this episode, but I think you guys are going to enjoy it, and I'll just let it at that. So please, guys, before we listen to this episode, would you do me a favor? Please check out the sponsors, the shows that partner with this, the companies that partner with the show. They do wonders for us. They support us with their resources, which helps support this show to bring this content. And I know you guys probably get tired of hearing about ads and stuff like that. However, there's a lot of value that comes from that, and I encourage you guys to check it out. So, Radix Hunting. Please check out the Monarch Series blind. If you're looking for a blind to use during turkey season, I encourage you to check out the Monarch. They have a series of pop-up all the way up to the hard shell blinds. They also got a long list of other things, from tree stands and trail cameras, feeders and feeder states. They've got a good list of gear to please check out at radixhunting.com. Also, Little Mountain Outfitters. For those of you who don't know, Devon Zimmerman, owner, operator of Little Mountain Outfitters, he was the guy that actually started this podcast. He and I started this together, and it's been a wild ride going through this, but as his business has grown, you know, he wasn't able to continue doing this podcast, and I guess I had too much time on my hands, and I continued it. So my friend Devon has built his business up, and it's my favorite bow shop to go to, and if you're close to Richland, Pennsylvania, I encourage you to go through. The slogan is everything bow hunting, and it truly is that and beyond with what they have. Now, if you would like to support a small local business, but you can't get to Richland, Pennsylvania, or you're just outside of that little bubble where you want to drive, go to littlemountainoutfitters.com, and you can check out everything they have in the store. It's on their website, and if you use the code WOODSMAN10, that's Woodsman10, you get 10% off on your next purchase with them. Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
All right, back with my friend, Mr. Chris Romano. Chris, thanks for coming on to my show again. What's going on?
Oh, thanks for having me, Mitch. Not a whole lot, man. You know, it's same old, same old. Wake up, do the dad thing, go to work, do the work thing, come home, do the arrow building thing, and wake up the next day and do it all again, you know?
I thought of you at dinner time tonight, so you're going to laugh at this. So my wife, she works 3 days a week, and today was her day off. So a lot of time her day off, she's doing, you know, some grocery shopping and stuff to catch up throughout the week. And she asked me what I wanted for dinner. I'm like, I don't care. Do something simple. I said, you want me to just pull, you know, some meat out of the freezer and we can make, you know, spaghetti and meat sauce? Yeah, that sounds good. So she made it. And I see her in the kitchen when she gets home. She's got flour and she's got all this stuff out. Like, she gets this bag of bread flour, which she never gets. And she had it in her head that she was going to get she was going to make homemade garlic knots. She got yeast and made these homemade garlic knots with all these special ingredients. And I thought of you because I thought, like, first of all, we ate these. And I'm a bread nut. And they were so freaking good. I was, like, in seventh heaven. But I thought of you because I thought, my Italian friend probably has a lot of really good Italian recipes. So my question to you when I was thinking of you was, what is the one dish or side piece or something that you have, whether it's a family gathering or a family recipe or something, that is just like, ah, oh, you can't beat it?
Yeah, so on any Saturday, no matter how early you woke up, my grandmother already beat you to the kitchen table, and there were already hundreds of ravioli. Homemade ravioli sitting on the table. And she would make them on a Saturday, and she'd make enough for like a month for every Sunday dinner. And till this day, I cannot eat ravioli unless it's the family recipe. And the problem is, if you know anything about, you know, the older generation, they never wrote a single thing down. And they don't even have measurements like, you know, a tablespoon of this or a cup of that. It's all by
a handful, a pinch.
Yes. It's a handful, and she did it by feel. So as she was working the dough, if it needed more flour, she put more flour in, you know? So that would be number one. If you ask me my favorite meal of all time that I can't have anywhere else, it's ravioli. But to go with the ravioli, you can't just use store-bought sauce. So my family also makes homemade pasta sauce. Actually, this past summer, we made it for the first time in, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. But we get like 15 to 20 bushels of tomatoes. We get the whole family together, and everyone's got a station. Who's cutting, who's crushing, who's putting it in the machine to grind it up, who's working the boiler, you know, and then we jar them all up. And, you know, you put a basil leaf in, a couple scoops of the sauce, another basil leaf, put them in the jars, and we don't eat them for at least a year. You know, we let them cure kind of like wine. So if you had to ask me all time, it'd be ravioli. If you asked me anything else, it'd be the sauce.
Oh my gosh. I don't understand how any Italian can be skinny. Cause like every time I eat Italian food, I'm just like, I'm not Italian in any way, shape or form. There's nothing Italian about me other than my interest in the cuisine. It's absolutely fantastic when I have stuff that's good. So our spaghetti was nothing special. You would have wrinkled your nose to it. I could get it down because it had pork meatballs and I was happy with that. But the garlic knots, oh my gosh, I was in seventh heaven.
That sounds amazing, man. And honestly, I got to tell you, I'm a little spoiled because on my family side, we got the Italian food. So I'm not crazy about eating Italian out. And then on my wife's side, her father is like a competition barbecuer. Goes around the country competing in like barbecue competitions. And a few years ago, he got like first place in like the world food competition for best burger at the event. So I'm kind of spoiled when it comes to Italian and barbecue.
Oh my gosh, I'll say you get. Which, speaking of that, we were talking off air before we started. You were talking about life and, you know, watching your little kid grow up a little. And I was wondering, wing and tail outdoors. You know, there's not a lot of wing and tail to chase this time of year, other than your wife. So I was wondering if you have number two on the way yet.
No, we don't. No. This one has been more than we could have asked for, but it's been a roller coaster, man. You know how it goes. It's the most fun roller coaster ride I've ever been on, and it's a never ending one. You know, so every time we figure something out, something else comes up. You know, whether it's her talking or starting to walk, now we got to keep our eyes on her 24/7. You know what she likes. Now she's got an opinion. So if she doesn't want to eat something, or if she doesn't like what she ate last night, doesn't want to have it again, she pushes your hand away. you know, one of the coolest things, and we've kind of talked about this before, you're a musician, you play guitar, and I play guitar as well. And it's kind of cool because I stopped playing for a while, simply because other things kind of took up my time. And once my daughter was born, I started playing for her. And from the moment she was able to comprehend that music was playing, she was completely drawn to it. But now that she's walking and she's got, you know, full control over her hands and picking things up, she comes over to my guitar while I'm playing, moves my hand off the strings, and starts strumming it herself. And then I'll try to like take over again, and she pushes my hand away and laughs at me and then starts strumming. And when she's done with it, she puts my hand back and tells me to play again.
I can echo all that because I've experienced the same thing with my kids playing a little bit. And like I know we got some differences in what our forte and taste in music is. Like, I've always been an old country music fan. Like, I love the 50s, 60s, 70s into the 80s of country music, and I really love Merle Haggard. And there's a song that a lot of people are probably familiar with called Mama Tried. And that song, for some reason, that struck a chord with both of my kids. And there's something funny about watching my he was 2 and 3 years old, learning to talk at the time, in the backseat of the truck, saying he wanted that to be played on the truck, and then hearing this little kid scream at the top of his lungs all the lyrics to that music, and then for me to play it on the guitar. It's just comical. It's just one of those things that's special to you, nobody else other than you. And it's a fun part of watching your kids grow and develop and become their own person.
Yeah, it's amazing. And don't think I didn't pick up on what you did there. Struck a chord, huh?
You know, I didn't even think about that. I guess it was just secondhand nature.
It just comes naturally. What can you say? No, but it's been great, man. You know, I sing her to sleep, and she loves it. You know, she'll be crying, and I'll start singing for her, and, you know, she'll settle down. And sometimes she doesn't even sleep. You know, it's funny because Danielle will be trying to put her down, and she'll start crying. I'll pick her up and I'll start singing. And when she's done with it, she reaches for her mother again, you know? So it's kind of cool to see how at not even a year old, she'll be 11 months and 7 days from today as we record this. She'll be 7 months actually, or 11 months on the day that this will air, I assume next week. So she, it's really cool to see how she's starting to have her preferences with things, you know? She prefers to be with her mother in the nighttime, but she likes to be around me during the day, you know. When she's excited, that she'll be around either of us. Sometimes one of us can calm her down or the other one can. It's just really cool. It's the same with the food, you know. So it's just really cool to see how at such a young age she already is starting to like pick and choose the things she likes or the things she wants, which on one hand is awesome, and on the other hand I feel like I've got my work cut out for me as she gets older, because opinions only grow.
Well, that's true, and I don't know the dynamic of daddy and daughter, because I don't have daughters. I have two sons, and I'm sure it's going to be very different for you than it is, because my boys, you know, they're definitely their own little people and have their attitudes. But dad gets to the point where he doesn't want to rock them to sleep. He wants to throw them in bed and smack them with a pillow a couple times until they go to sleep sometimes. But now parenthood is something, and you know, one of the things I'm hoping that they take interest to, and I'm trying to incorporate them as much as this, you know, what we're on here talking about, is the outdoors and our hunt interests and hunting and shooting and, you know, fishing or whatever that outdoor passion is. And, you know, I've had Lucas shooting a bow. I've had Wyatt shooting a bow, and I'm trying to figure out when the right time is for him to go from, you know, the little rubber tabs that he has on the string that he can just pull it back and point the arrow and just let it fly and fling it. I'm trying to figure out when he's ready to go from just flinging arrows and just, you know, putting stickers on the target and just shooting at him to setting his it's one of those little bear bows, and I'd love to get, when he's ready, set it up with all the accessories to shoot compound, and I'd really like to get him to start shooting a release aid the way I think it should be taught, and trying to get him to prevent, you know, the whole punching and everything else. And that's something that dad selfishly wants, but I'm also trying to be cognizant that he might not want to do that, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Sure. You know, and it's all about the progression. You know, the best we can do is expose them to it, show them how much fun it is, and show them how it relates to life and how lessons can be learned in the woods that can be taken from the woods into the real world, you know, and whatever comes from that may, you know, maybe our kids will just want to be archers and they won't want to hunt. I'd be okay with that. Maybe she doesn't want to shoot at all. And I won't lie, a little bit of me will hurt if she says that she's not interested, you know, but that's kind of the beauty of this, right? It's just like clay. You can mold it and you can shape it into what you want, but at the end of the day, once you put it in the kiln, it's going to do its thing, you know? So it's very much the same, at least from my perspective. But yeah, you're farther along that road than I am, so you have a little bit more insight than I do.
Well, I don't know that I have any more smart insight. You talked about progression, and I think that's a pretty good point to kind of segue into some of the stuff I wanted to chat about with you. And you know, I think about progression. We all go through progression in different stages of what we're doing, whether it's being a dad, whether it's being a hunter, or being an archer and taking your archery skills to the next level. And you have been, from my point of view, from the outside looking in, it looks like you've really been grinding and tinkering in the world of taking your bow and your shooting and your accuracy and your statistics to the next level for overall improving Chris Romano's archery experience, whether that be on target or in the field hunting. And there's a lot going on there. And I don't know how we get into this conversation, but when you think about all the stuff and where you've gone and where you're at now with archery, where's the beginning point, and how do you take this complex system of archery and break it down into layman's terms for people that get their bow out of the case a month before archery season?
Sure. To be honest with you, I don't know where it starts. I mean, my start in archery was around 15 years old, so a little bit more than half of my life ago. I'm 34 years old now. But to be honest with you, I never really started taking it seriously until probably around the time I graduated college and moved to New Hampshire. So I would say that was around 2018. So we're going on about 8 years ago now that I really buckled down. And I said, let me really dive into this hunting thing and let me learn how to be a good hunter rather than just a good killer, if you will. So around that time, I had found Ranch Fairy and I started making super high FOC arrows and doing my thing. And then somewhere along the lines, I found Dorge through Fire Knock, mm-hmm. and started looking into that, heard some podcasts, and I started listening to the science of arrow flight. And as a math guy and numbers guy, you know, stats and charts and stuff, they mean a lot to me because it takes all the emotion out of everything. You know, everyone thinks their bow brand is the best bow brand and their arrow company is the best arrow company and their broadhead is the best broadhead. But if you take the emotion out of it and you just look at facts, maybe it's not. So when I started hearing these podcasts and stuff about optimization and maximizing performance and hearing about some of those downfalls of heavy FOC, I decided to go a different route and go a little bit more of a balanced arrow. And once I saw how that little bit of change made such a big difference, just going from a heavier arrow with high FOC to a little bit of a lighter arrow but more balanced, and watching that change in trajectory and seeing how my arrow behaved better, both on target, like in the air and in my pin gaps, that's all it took for me to say, okay, how much further can we go with this? You know, and I like to say on part of it, it's all about being the most ethical hunter you can and the most proficient in the time it takes for an animal to expire. You know, a lot of guys will sit there and say, you know, oh, you know, killing an animal doesn't bother me. And I'm not going to say it bothers me, but I feel something when I shoot a deer. Mm-hmm. I feel something when I shoot a pheasant, you know, because something was just breathing. Now it's not. I did that. And I feel like we owe it to them to make that as quick as possible and to respect them before, during, and after the hunt. But the other side of that is I'm a short draw guy, man. You saw we shot TAC together, or we shot the R100 last mm-hmm. year. And I can only get so much out of my bows. I'm a 27 and a half inch draw length. I'm up to 70 pounds. I don't think there's a need to go up to 80. So I'm very limited just with my biology. So I can't change my draw length. I'm not willing to go up any higher in draw weight. So the only thing I could do is try to bleed every bit of energy out of my bow and get it sent down range. And that's the rabbit hole I decided to dive down, and I haven't found the bottom yet.
Well, and I don't think we ever do, because you're always learning when you're doing stuff, and a lot of the careers and interests and topics that we get into. So you are way more versed into this than I am. So, like, I stopped with my arrow journey when I found how to make an arrow system work to shoot the broadhead I wanted to shoot. So, like, my arrow journey was, I was shooting a bow. I was shooting years ago. I used to shoot the Bowtech Destroyer 340, and it was 340 IBO. And that thing was fast. And the arrow setup I was shooting with a 100-grain broadhead, I forget what my weight setup and everything else was. I just know that I shot it through a chrono, and it was at 305. And I thought, that's whipping fast. But I could not shoot... I could not shoot anything besides a mechanical broadhead. And, you know, everybody has their opinions. I've just had some more negative experiences, and it's probably just the situation I put them in, not that it was the broadhead's fault. It was the operator. But I remember I shot a Grim Reaper broadhead at a doe one time, less than 20 yards. I made a poor shot. I hit a little bit high, and I caught the shoulder blade. Now, I was shooting a very steep angle. I'm going back on memory. I felt like I should have been able to break through the shoulder blade at that distance with everything I had going, and I made it to the insert, and the arrow broke out. So it just turned me off, right? I had a bad experience. And then I went down the rabbit hole a little bit of Ranch Fairy, went to the extreme side, didn't really like it. But I took some of those concepts and figured out an arrow that has been shooting, A, accurately, B, it's been... great as far as broadhead flight. I've been able to screw on a lot of different fixed blade broadheads, you know, from Magnus broadheads. I shot VPAs. I still have them both in my quiver at times. And I've just had really good luck. Anything that spins well, I'm getting fantastic arrow flight. And then I've also been getting, you know, very good success with the animals that I've shot them at. So from there, I found a new level of success in a couple different ways, and I was comfortable with that, and I didn't get into the rabbit hole of taking it to the next level. And I guess I've been hung up on, because I don't know enough, I've listened to, you know, the Ranch Fairy stuff like you have, and then you're talking about Dorge and the Fire Knox system and everything else that you're working through. One of the things I don't know is, there's a lot of information out there about arrow flight, but there's not a lot of information about arrows and what they do when they impact the target. And that's kind of where Ranch Fairy has made a stake and stuff. And, you know, they have their concepts. I don't really know anything beyond what they've talked about that, because nobody else is talking about that. So with all that in mind, all that verbiage that I just spilled out to get to this point, my question is, what is actually going on target with the different arrow systems that are out there? I mean, and I don't know how you break that down. Maybe you just talk about it from the angle of what you're engaging in and what that means to you as far as performance on an animal.
Sure. Well, first off, the thing that mechanicals do for an arrow is it makes them extremely more aerodynamic. And they mask any shortcomings you have in bow tuning, spine, grip, torque, all that stuff that you can induce negatively into your arrow. So think about like a fixed blade broadhead on the front of your arrow, like a rotor. And as it's spinning, it's catching air and it's directing your arrow like a curveball would, spinning through air. So you kind of hit on something really big. You were like, I got my arrow to shoot the broadhead that I wanted. That's really where we always start, because there aren't a lot of arrows that can handle a very fast, there's not a lot of broadheads that can handle high speed, because they're not built for high speed. It all goes back to a lot of the stuff we use now, a lot of the things that have become standard in arrow building, bow setup, you know, this, that, the third, whatever, has all been around for 20-ish years, 25 years, but these bows haven't really realistically been able to hit 300 plus feet per second in real speed it for a very, very long time. So the faster, think about like vehicles. You're driving down the street, one person's driving a Corvette, the other person's driving a box truck. If you're driving down the street at 30 miles an hour, you're not really going to feel much of a difference. You go and hit 100 miles an hour, you're going to feel that box truck struggling. Meanwhile, the Corvette is cruising. You know, so the faster your arrow's traveling, the more important aerodynamics become, because it's maximized. So with that being said, that is part of what, from what I'm hearing, what I would venture to guess was going on with your setup back in the earlier days.
Absolutely.
Now, when you fire your arrow, there are a lot of different things that are going on. First off, your bow is compressing your arrow. because objects at rest stay at rest until acted upon by an outside force, Newton's law of physics. So the front of the arrow, when the heavier the front of the arrow is, the more the back of the arrow has to compress before the front can move. So one of the downsides of higher FOC is you induce more flex into your arrow at launch. And then the more flex it has at launch, the longer it takes to recover in the flight. So, and the longer it takes, the harder the arrow has to work. The harder the arrow has to work to continue flying in that direction, which bleeds a lot of energy. You know, so guys that are reading 300 feet per second on a chronograph at launch, who knows what they're hitting downrange. So when the bow launch, when you take your shot, your arrow is going to flex. Talked about that. The other thing that gets induced into your arrow is something called microflex. So it's essentially like a tuning fork that you would use to tune an instrument. And it's basically a piece of metal that's shaped basically like a field goal post. And you bang it on a table and it vibrates. And as it vibrates, it rings out a note. And based on the way it makes a different note. Very similar to, why can't I think right now? Oh my goodness, I had it and I lost it. But yeah, you hit it, it rings out, gotcha. It makes a note, and then when it stops, you know, when it stops vibrating, it stops ringing.
All right, everyone, it's that time of year where things are greening up and I'm starting to think about food plots. And if you're doing the same thing, look no farther than Vitalize Seed, specifically Nitro Boost spring and summer planting. It's the food plot that has the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen and add diversity to your food plot mix. It's highly browse tolerant and adds a ton of benefit, not just to the wildlife, but for your soil. 30% more diversity than any other food plot you're going to find, and it's engineered for the proper carbon to nitrogen ratio to naturally feed your soil biology and set you up for a fall food plot like no other. Diversity is king for your wildlife and for your soil. Look no farther and check out Vitalize Seed.
So those vibrations are very, very tight, very, very high frequency, low magnitude wavelengths, which means they just don't go very far from end to end. It's not something you can see, and it's not something that you can ever completely get rid of. But that microflex also drastically bleeds energy because the arrow is not perfectly still and just traveling straight. So when you're building your arrow or setting up your bow or whatever the case is, you want to do things that can mitigate that. Now, the specific question you asked was, how does an arrow behave on impact? Well, it really depends on how your arrow is built. The more weight that you have up front and the less weight you have out back, it moves that pivot point of the arrow more towards the front. So what happens is, let's take a high FOC build, for example. When it hits that animal, even if the arrow has recovered before it hits that animal, because there's nothing driving from the rear of the arrow and all the weight is in the front pulling it, the back of the arrow starts to shake again on impact. And what's happening is, as your arrow is trying to pass through the animal, it is also trying to stop that vibration as it's pulling through and banging against, you know, the side walls of the hole that you make. And that's why you see a lot of, you know, shots on camera or on video that don't fully pass through, even like in your case where it's a shorter shot, 14, 15 yards. Because the average arrow takes anywhere from 18 to 24 yards to stop flexing in air.
Well, that makes sense. And I've seen some videos of guys shooting game at a short distance with, you know, expandables, lighter spine setup arrows, probably, you know, questionable as far as if they're set up properly. I just know that when I properly spined my arrow, I had much better control. And the thing that they've always talked about as far as like the Ashby reports and stuff has always been spine your arrow by adjusting the weight accordingly in order to micro tune how you spine that arrow. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's where some people have landed right now. And, you know, the way I started out was, like, I went to the bow shop, and I said, I'm shooting a bow at this draw length and this spine, what arrow? And they give you the range of all the different arrows, and this is the spine arrow you shoot, and you put a 100-grain tip on it, and you roll. Then the Ashby reports come along, and you've got stuff that's, you know, telling you to micro-adjust it based off of tip weight and adjust your spine based off of all these parameters and the way you tune the bow based off of, you know, his recommendations. Where does how do you go into the world of adjusting your spine based off of, you know, the Dorge system, for my crude way of asking?
So the cool thing about Range Fairy is they take a lot of the, you need to know the technicality, so to speak, out of the arrow build. So he says, start with a 250 spine arrow, put as much weight on the front as you need until it shoots well. Technically, that's not wrong, mm-hmm. but it's because a 250 spine arrow is pretty overspined for just about most people's draw lengths and draw weights without putting that maximum weight on the front. Mm. So, for example, when we signed on here, you saw me indexing my arrows. When a typical spine test is done, they put the rollers that the arrow rests on exactly 28 inches apart from each other. Well, some arrows are 28 inches long, some arrows are 31 inches long. So the problem with the spine test is that you're testing 28 inches, you're testing 28 inches of range on an arrow, regardless how long the arrow is. But when you shoot your arrow, the energy is going from one end to the other. It doesn't know 28 inches. So the first thing we do is we put it on the indexer, when we find the first dynamic bend, which is essentially when you prop an arrow up on both ends as far as you can and apply pressure straight to the center, where does the arrow want to settle? And we do it all by hand and by feel. You push it down, you roll it until you feel it get stuck in a groove. Now, the higher the quality of the arrow, the less grooves you're going to have and the easier it is to find. Some arrows can have as many as 16 valleys in it, and you have to find which one sticks the most. And that's on, again, lower quality arrows. The better the carbon, the better the building system, the better the building process, the more the factory takes care in, you know, temperature and humidity, the more precise those things are going to be, you know. But what the spining or what indexing the arrows does is, if you've listened to Range Fairy, you've heard about knock tuning. Well, knock tuning is just turning your knock until you get all of your spines to align.
Yes.
We do it right from the build instead. Whereas in the Range Fairy system, you do it out on the range. You can get the same result in both ways. I'm not, and this isn't a sales pitch. That's not what I'm trying to do here. One saves time and one saves money. They both work. Me personally, when I build an arrow for myself, I ask myself, okay, I want my arrow to be somewhere between 400 and 450 grains. For a white-tailed deer, I don't see a need to be over that.
Right.
Because it only takes 23 pounds of energy at impact to pass through a deer. To give you an example, my bow last year was shooting 280 feet per second. I was shooting a 432 grain arrow, and I had like 76 foot-pounds of kinetic energy. Whereas a 650 grain arrow traveling 220 feet per second has 83 foot-pounds of kinetic energy. I'm willing to give up that 6 pounds of energy for that trajectory. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So there's two different schools of thought. High FOC works. However, the only thing when you're building a higher FOC arrow is you need to understand that you're going to lose energy in flight from the launch. You're going to burn energy on, like, instantaneously on impact because that arrow is getting pulled through. But where high FOC ends up working is because there's so much extra kinetic energy that you have enough to waste. And then, you know, if you were, you know, back to, sorry, I wanted to mention your mechanical earlier.
Yeah.
Again, taking a motion completely out of it, anything that moves takes energy. So when those blades open, you could bleed anywhere from 10 to 15 pounds of energy just in opening that blade. You know, so if you take large amounts of flex at launch, flex at impact, and a mechanical and put them all together, now who knows if you're at that 23 or not. You know what I mean? So when it comes to me building an arrow, I start with what my end goal wants to be, that 400, 450 grain arrow. I know my spine is 350. I pick my shaft based on that, you know. For example, the 204 build that I'm working on right now, if I were to use Dorge's arrow, it would be a little bit heavier than I want to be. So I'm testing out a couple different arrows to see which one gets me in the weight and which one performs the way I want. So that's kind of how I go about deciding what components or, you know, how I'm going to build it. But me personally, I prefer a balanced arrow. My arrow last year was 7% FOC.
The first and foremost thing, like, I don't remember all the Ashby rules and reports from beginning to end, because I don't know that I have to. I do remember that the first rule that they talk about is perfect aeroflight.
Yes.
And 100%. you're achieving your goal. All of our goal is achieving the same thing. I think it's mm-hmm. just a different way of getting there. So
100%.
How, I guess what one of the things I've struggled with knowing is, like, how do you make the decision what's right for you when it comes to shooting your bow? At what point in where is there a line in the sand of where you want to go from this point, and the only way that I improve myself or improve my setup and get better is if I take it to this next level in technicality of my arrow build?
Yeah. And that's honestly kind of where I'm at right now. I haven't found that limit yet. I haven't found that line in the sand. To be honest, right now, my goal is 300 feet per second. I've never hit it before. Closest I've ever gotten was 292. That was maybe three bows ago. And once I hit 300, I'm going to keep pushing the limit until I see diminished returns. Right now, my arrows are flying great. They're hitting their mark. And with speed, you just have to be a little bit more precise. And I think that's kind of what intrigues me with all this, is where's that limit? Where is that point where I say, this is too fast, or this is too much power, or the bow is too poppy, and it's time to turn around. But the truth is, when it comes to building and setup, there's only so much you can do with your arrow. If you can get it to recover as fast as possible, and you can get it to fly as flat as possible, and you could put vanes on in a configuration that induces the least amount of drag, and we can touch on that a little bit more if you want, because that's a pretty big topic in the space as far as drag and offset and helical and all that stuff. But once you find a build that flies well and it flies true, and you can't go down in spine, and you're already using the components that you want to use, the only next step is to start making changes with your bow. And that's kind of the place where I'm at. I feel like I found a really good arrow. I feel like the one I built for myself does everything I want. It hasn't let me down yet. So now I'm focusing on my bow. I feel like for now, I'm not going to say that forever. For now, I'm content with my arrow build. I am testing out a 204, same exact build, just on a 204. And now it's time for me to take my focus and move it to my bow and say, okay, what can I do to my bow that will allow it to deliver the most amount of energy to my arrow at launch?
So you talked about drag, vanes, and all this stuff. And there's a lot of information out there. I think it's like anything else in life. You get bits and pieces from different entities, and you try to piece together a hypothesis or formation. You might have preconceived notions based on something tell you, but you're not getting the full picture until you bring it full circle. That happens in so many aspects of life. In mm-hmm. the hunting world, we don't get the whole picture and we form opinions. In wildlife management, I do it in farming all the time with my jobs. Like, I get asked questions all the time that people, get a piece of information and tell me something, and they might be sort of true, but they're not completely true. So on the topic of arrows, and as I'm listening to you talk about this, I'm thinking about how I've learned to build arrows, how I've built arrows, and then you've built arrows for me, and it's amazing the differences between them. They're fantastic, but there's science there that I'm not fully comprehending in my own mind. So, like, for me, when I build arrows, mm-hmm. it all started, I followed the guidelines of, the industry standard and shot a fast arrow, but I couldn't shoot a broadhead, and I had a hard time tuning my bow. So that led me down the rabbit hole of changing arrow spines. I went down the Ashby, logic of, weight and adjusting your spine and everything else. Even before the Ashby reports, I had heard that going from a 3-fletch to a 4-fletch would really help stabilize fixed blade broadheads. And that actually was an intermediate step for me, and I did that. And I still fletch 4 feathers on because that's what worked for me, and then I continued to progress, and I never left that. Mm-hmm. Now, I've had a theory for a couple reasons, and I don't need to drag on this question on too long. build up to it, but I believe that the amount of drag on my arrows is significantly higher with four, as well as the profile of the shaft, and I think it makes more noise as it's approaching the target, and I think that creates, I think that's where string ducking happens the most. That's my theory. So, like, how do you go about, like, I always shot my bow bare shaft and saw which way at 6 feet my arrow would twist. And whichever way it would twist, I would put that offset or that helical to it, and I put four fletch on it, and then I'd stick my broadhead on it, and I'd walk away. So where am I not seeing the complete total picture with the way I'm currently doing it?
So... all vanes on the most vanes on the market, they work off of drag, right? So what you're saying is 100% accurate. The more vanes you have on the back of your arrow, the more drag that is induced. And it's doing two things. First off, the back of the arrow has more drag, so it's staying stable, which forces the front of the arrow to align with the back of the arrow. But second, it's slowing the arrow down. And there comes a point, we were talking about earlier, once you get below a certain speed, aerodynamics aren't as important. Your arrow can level off and it can fly. And again, that works. A lot of people use them. I know a lot of people who still use four fletch and they love them, you know? The other side of that though, and what Dorge ended up doing was he designed a vane that doesn't use drag to steer the arrow or to spin the arrow. And the way it works is the vanes are designed in a way, if you were to look at them from the front or the back, they're a very, very tight triangle. He calls it a delta. Delta in math is a triangle. So that's step number one. Step number two is there are three different zones on that vein, and each zone has a different texture pattern. And then the magic in it all is that one side of the vein creates more pressure than the other. And it functions like an airplane. He basically went into, he spoke to like a someone really, you know, high up in the aerospace world, and they helped him design the vanes. And essentially what, just like water moves to the path of least resistance, so does something moving through the air. So the way he designed his arrows is that the little bit of drag that it does induce is the force is applied on the same side of the vein as the high pressure air, which forces the vein to turn like crazy. I think something like they can do somewhere around the arrow vane too, the ones I put on your arrows. Mm-hmm. Once you hit a certain speed, they could do about 130 or 145 revolutions every 20 yards.
Holy cow.
Which is just insane. Yeah. And that revolution helps to stabilize your arrow, you know? But you mentioned something else here. You said you index your arrow, you shoot a bare shaft, you put a mark on it, you see which way it turns. I used to do that too. It just made sense. If from the moment you launch your arrow, everything is spinning in the same direction, there's no lost energy. But then I started diving into it a little bit further, and I heard enough professionals say that the vanes take over before that index ever starts. And I decided that that was the one thing that I could change, mainly because there are a lot of companies out there that offer left helical broadheads, no problem. But there are also companies who only offer right helical. Dorge happens to be one of them. And I knew I knew all the stuff that I wanted to use and stuff, and I wanted to try the vanes out. And once I heard about the indexing thing, which was my only reserve about, you know, not putting a helical on or whatever, it was a non-factor for me anymore. The way his are designed, they only turn to the right, so you have to use a right helical if you want to use a right bevel if you want to use a single bevel. But that's really the difference between a straight fletch that's working in air, like with airfoil technology, versus a helical or an offset that is purposely inducing drag on your arrow.
We're bouncing around. It's because my mind is bouncing over to like because
I'm bouncing around too, man.
A lot of this, well. The reason I'm bouncing around is, number one, I didn't have an agenda because I'm a slob when it comes to organization. But number two, I'm asking you questions comparing it to my arrow build and what I've learned about mm-hmm. arrows. And you're way more versed in arrow builds and understanding it than I am. So I want to learn how can I improve. And like I've mm-hmm. based it off of information, like I said, little bits of context. And one of the things you're talking about with the revolutions, one of the things I haven't dove into too much, but I've heard people talk about is arrows parachuting at a long distance, and it has something to do mm-hmm. with spinning too much or something with the drag setup, and I've heard people talking about that, and I didn't quite understand that. And then I went down, well, is mine doing that same thing? Like, if I'm shooting at a long distance, 80, 100 yards, like, how do you tell? How do you correct it? Like, and then now we're talking about 120 or 130 revolutions every 20 yards. Like, that sounds wild. So how do I process that?
To be honest with you, that's one thing I haven't really dove into. I know ballooning happens. I haven't seen it affect my comfortable range of shooting. Mm-hmm. I've shot out to 100 yards. I haven't seen any crazy effects to it. But I have talked to Dorge about it, and he said that it could happen. You know, the faster your arrow is traveling at launch, the worse it's going to be downrange when you get to that distance. But at the end of the day, the arrow that I'm building is for hunting. I shoot long distance to practice and get better, so that way the 50-yard shots don't seem difficult at all. But at the end of the day, if an arrow is planing, the only place it's going to parachuting, the only place it's going to affect me is on the practice range or at a 3D course, you know? So and we talked about this at R100 last year. I shoot the same arrow year round, because if I do, I know exactly how it's going to shoot. I know what I can shoot under, what I can't shoot under. I know the trajectory. I know what's in my way and what's not, you know, and it's just familiarity. And if you're always, for me personally, if I shoot a different arrow, let's say I go to tack. I use tack as a way to practice for hunting season. It is rugged terrain, steep, realistic shots. So why would I not want to use the hunting arrow that I'm going to make those shots at in real time?
Especially if you're a hunter, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, but as far as it affecting, could it happen? Yeah. Is it a thing? Yeah. Do I know a lot about it? I don't either.
And the reason I never dove into it is because you hear professionals talk about that. But let's face it, the professionals are the guys. I just saw a video the other day of somebody asking, like, a group of people. I don't know if it was like at ATA or something, but I think it was Lancaster Archery, went around to all these different professionals and asked them, like, what's the maximum ethical distance that they would take a game animal at? And these guys are shooting game animals well over 100 yards without a problem because they're freaks with their bow, and I have no problem them doing that. I'm not at that level. I just said on a podcast I did the other day, like, my effective shooting range has decreased because my training and my shooting has slacked off. I'm not as strong as I used to be. We were talking before we started, like, my work and stuff, my stress level's higher, and when I carry stress, I carry tight shoulders and muscles. I don't shoot as well as I used to. So for me to focus on something about parachuting, I got a lot bigger problems shooting at long distance than parachuting because I'm not that good.
Yeah. Since we're on the topic of long distance, I actually, in all of this research and talking with Dorge and talking with other people who are, you know, well versed in this stuff as well, I came across something that is almost counterintuitive, but it makes so much sense when you think about it from an arrow's perspective. When you're on YouTube, Instagram, watching hunting videos, a reel shows up, how many, if you had to put a number on it, more or less than 40 videos you've seen of deer shot under 20 yards and the arrow not fully passed through?
I think it's probably higher than most would think. And I always blame that on impacting bone, quartered shots and stuff like that. And I would also challenge that it's some of the shot angles we're choosing to take in this day and age because of the information out there. I think there's more riskier shots being taken, which induces bone, which is, you know, a medium that's harder to penetrate all the way through. But I think I know where you're coming from that, but I don't know the answer to that. But I think it's probably less than we realize. Like, if you said 1 in 40 videos, how many deer did we not pass through? I bet you it's about a third.
Yeah. And that's under 20 yards.
Yes.
Now, how many times have you seen a shot taken at 50 or 60 yards and not pass through the deer?
Well, you've got a smaller sample size there. And one of the things I know what you're getting at. I know you're talking about you're getting that arrow flight and that arrow recovering down range is where I think you're going with that. Mm-hmm. So the people that are shooting long distance are a heck of a lot better shots than I am. And most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time when people shoot at a longer distance, they are being very, very deliberate in making sure they've got a maximum safe shot. So I see more of the broadside shots at a calm animal whenever you see that distance. And therefore, I think you see more pass-throughs. So that would I would say of all that, I think it's two-thirds as you see past higher than that, maybe higher. I don't know.
It's a lot, and you hit the nail on the head, man. It's the recovery. You know, sure, there's bone, but think about how much power we have coming out of our bows and how much power there's still in that arrow at a 10-yard shot. Mm-hmm. Unless you hit that knuckle, that hardest bone in their body, I don't think you shouldn't be able to break through it. Right. Now, with the mechanical, maybe. You know, we talked about that kind of stuff, but if you're shooting a single bevel or any kind of fixed blade and you make solid contact and that arrow performs, I don't see why it wouldn't pass through the shoulder. Now, but a lot of people are worried about taking long range shots because most of what I hear is the equipment isn't effective enough to make that shot. I would venture to say that the biggest issue you have at a long distance shot is the deer moving, because it has more time to take a step while it's eating or stand up and look around because it heard a noise in the other direction. But when it comes to taking a long shot and performance, I don't have a problem taking a shot at a deer 50, 60 yards. If it's open and it's ethical and I know I can make the shot, I'm not, you know, telling people go sling arrows around, you know, but what we should be worrying when it comes to a long distance shot, we should be worrying more about what the deer could do to mess up our shot than thinking about whether or not our equipment can perform. And that's kind of the role I take with that.
Well, that's interesting because like what I grew up on with bow hunting and what was like imprinted on me as a bow hunter is this blanket statement: arrows don't pass through bone. And the statement was made based off of the shoulder. And I'm not talking about the thin scapula. I'm not talking about ribs. I'm talking about the humerus, the knuckle where the humerus and the scapula meet, the spine, stuff like that. That's where that came from. That was pounded into my head. And my experience thus far has been there's some truth to that. I've seen, like from my own shots and the little bit of testing and tinkering I've done, I haven't seen arrows completely break and bust through with the setups I've used hitting that type of bone. I've seen them glance if you have enough momentum where you hit and it chips and it kind of steers direction and still goes into the vital zone and kills that deer. So my question to you is, do you think that's because that statement has been made because we didn't have the information that we have today, that we didn't have the perfect arrow flight, we didn't have the setups that were capable of it? So at a time that was true, but do you believe that that's not true anymore?
I think everything you said is accurate, but I also think that the bows weren't putting anywhere near the output that they are now. You know, we're talking, for the testing that I'm going to be doing this summer, I just got myself the Sicario. 358 feet per second bow. A few years back, I had an Expedition that was a 362 foot per second bow. Hoyt just put out another model that's 343 feet per second. Matthews just put out a model that's 348 feet per second. I mean, these bows are putting out insane numbers. Meanwhile, the Matthews that I got back in 2004, I think had like an IBO of 315. Again, that's at, if you're familiar with IBO testing, they test them at 30 inch draw length, 70 pounds, exactly five grains per inch on the arrow. And that's how they run their tests. You know, so when you think about, when you buy a bow, you're like, oh man, this bow is a blazer. That's only if you're 5 grains per inch, 30 inch draw length, shooting 70 pounds. And if you're not, everything you either add to your arrow to add weight or take away from the bow in draw length or draw weight, you're taking away from that speed. You know, so when we buy a bow and we say, oh, you know, this is an IBO of 350, we should really be thinking of it more in the sense of, okay, 315, I'd be happy. 300, I'd be happy. Like, you got a pretty long draw length, you know, so hitting 300 for you is no big deal. For me, it's like a pipe dream. And once I hit it, now I'm going to shoot for 315, you know, so... That's kind of where I'm at with that. But to answer your question, I think it's a combination of the... Well, mind you, also back then they were using aluminum arrows.
Oh yeah,
and aluminum arrows. Don't get me wrong; they work. They actually fly better and perform better than carbon arrows in flight. But the problem with aluminum arrows is the spines break down. You can only take about 90 shots with them before the spine isn't the same spine anymore. And with aluminum, once it bends, that arrow's done. So now, just thinking about it, I don't have any knowledge or anything about this, but I would imagine with a aluminum arrow out of a bow, even if it's shooting 270 feet per second, that makes impact on bone under 20 yards, I would venture to guess you're going to find a bend in that aluminum shaft somewhere. So all of those things combined, you know, like you said, the first most important thing of arrow flight is arrow I can't think of the word, help me out here.
Arrow stability or arrow perfect arrow flight?
Perfect arrow flight, yeah, but it's the I can't think of the word right now. But if you can build an arrow that functions, stays together, doesn't break, and performs on impact, and by performs I mean doesn't start flexing again, drives as one unit, you're going to get the most out of everything. So I think today people are a lot less worried about shooting close to that shoulder than they were 30 years ago.
That makes sense. And like I said, I think this is all good information to process. One thing I'm going to always preface with this is, number one, when you're making decisions about the animal you shoot, regardless of how good your setup is, number one, you got to make your own decision of and be as realistic as you possibly can of how good of a shot are you in order to make a good, ethical, clean shot, whether that's distance, whether that's angle, what have you. Like, you got to make sure you're doing your due diligence in your shooting capability. And the second thing is, understand the anatomy of the animal that you're shooting. I think I'm amazed at how many people I've watched videos and they'll describe what the arrow hit. And then where you see the impact and everything else is like, you're really not even in the same ballpark. Like, you don't even understand the way, the shape, the geometry and the physiology of the animal that you're targeting. And to be frank, I didn't either until I started butchering my own deer when I was in high school. And when I started processing the animal and breaking it down and paying attention to where organs and everything else laid and where bones were and where muscles were and stuff, like, that drastically helped me shoot deer. Same thing with a bow. There's a lot of same thing with bear. There's a lot of bad information out there about where to shoot a bear. And I didn't know until I shot a couple and I paid attention to where their organs laid and how their bones laid, and I kind of see, yeah, some of the information out there is actually not good. So those are two things that I think are really, really important as you go on this journey, because as we said, like, the perfect arrow flight is a foundation. I think it's a foundation to making sure you do a good ethical job of taking your game.
100%. You know, and Cody DiAquisto came out, I think, in the last year or two and said, everybody wants to shoot up at the shoulder because that's where the heart is. And I get it. He said, but what happens if you miss on the shoulder side? Now you're hitting shoulder and you may or may not pass through. And now you have either a wounded animal or an animal that's going to take a few days to recover. Cody likes to aim 5 or 6 inches back from the edge of the shoulder blade. So if he misses back, he's getting into the liver and a little bit longer of an expiration, but still a kill shot. Or if he misses a little right, he's just giving himself a whole window of forgiveness, you know, which is great. I think that's awesome. You know, anything, I'm huge on variables, man. Anything that I can do to stack more variables on my side of the field, that's what I'm going to do, you know, and, you know, within reason. I'm not going to go crazy, you know, but I agree with you. You know, the big thing about bear, everyone thought you shot a bear the same place you shoot a deer. And I just found out last year it's middle, which on a deer is like, what are you hitting there if you shoot it there? You know what I mean?
There's definitely some truth to that. Yeah, the middle thing is really interesting, because when you look at the geometry and the proportions of a bear, I think I understand how that phrase came up. But I've seen some people talking about doing that and shooting bear in the gut. So it's there is a line there. Like, to me, I've always thought that the right way to shoot a bear is about 4 inches behind the shoulder, rather than if you go back 8 inches, that's like what people think is the middle of the middle. And it goes back to your whole thing about proportions in like their margin of error. Like if you shoot, mm-hmm. it's the opposite of Cody. So you said about Cody likes to shoot like the liver type thing. That way he's got a little bit bigger margin of error within that bowling ball sized or a little bit smaller window of kill zone. Well, it's this, mm-hmm. You're doing the exact opposite with a bear when you do the middle of the middle concept, in my opinion, because I think you actually, if you miss too far, like if the bear is facing from left to right, if you miss too far to the right, you're in the intestines. Now, is it a lethal shot? It is. In fact, I would make the argument that bear kill easier with that type of shot than a deer does. I don't think they go as far, and I think they expire quicker. But it's the same concept. So I think like the margin of error and where you aim is like the center of the vitals. And I think the best way to describe that is probably not doing it is when you kill an animal that you're hunting and you don't truly know, like break the animal down and learn it. Like that's something nobody talks about. But in my opinion, that's how you learn more about the animals. Like I remember listening to Troy Pottinger on a podcast one time. And he was talking about how he took a deer that he harvested and took it apart and then put the bones back together for an anatomy and physiology class. He said, and he talked about how much he learned about a whitetail by doing that necropsy and breaking it down. Well, that's absurd to me, but at the same time, he probably knows a little bit more than the average guy who just goes out and shoots deer once in fall. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that sounds really cool. And I've been following a little bit closer with the Anatomy Hunter as well. I don't know if you've seen any of his stuff on Instagram, but he's doing some real cool stuff. He's putting like air hoses into the deer's mouth and reinflating the lungs so you can see exactly where they sit and how they sit and oriented. It's really fascinating stuff, man.
It is.
And I agree, the more you know about what you're aiming at and where you're aiming, the better you're going to be. There's no argument here.
Right. And the biggest thing that I'm going to take away and I'm going to tell people that listen to this if they're still listening is like from my point of view, in my opinion, Chris knows way more about arrow flight than I do. But I have my own opinions and that's because they've been formed by my own experiences. But that doesn't mean I should make judgment and accusation upon Chris's setup and Chris's decisions based off of my experiences, because Chris is an experienced hunter. He's an experienced archer. He puts a lot of hard work into it. We have differing experiences that led us to the point where we're at. But I don't look to saying that Chris's way is wrong. In fact, I take everything Chris has said, and I'm going to apply it to my bow setup because I learned a lot from this conversation. And I continue, every time I talk about arrows with Chris, I learn more and think about how am I going to improve myself as an archer. I'm saying this because I feel like in the world of archery hunting and hunting in general, there's so much ego involved and everybody's is the best. You said it earlier, like everybody's broad has the best, their bow's the best. And it's the Ford Dodge Chevy conversation. My opinion is all three of those trucks suck. You just got to pick the one that you want to go and stick with it and shut the heck up. Like that's just right. How I feel about it. And I think it's the same thing with the bow and stuff. Like, pick the one, the gear that you're good with, do something that makes you comfortable, stick with it, but then push the limits in how you can get yourself better and use Chris's experiences, use your neighbor's experiences as something to help formulate what's best for you, and don't belittle everybody when they've got a differing opinion or different set of experiences, because that's how we end up in the division side of things, and there's no reason for that whatsoever.
Absolutely. And the other side of that, too, is we got to think back 5 years ago. And think about how much innovation there's been in the hunting industry in the last 5 years.
A lot.
What I have now could be the best right now. Maybe it's not. But who's to say it's still the best in 5 years?
Right.
You know, so I'm not trying to knock what anybody else is doing. I've said on my podcast throughout all of these, you know, Science of Aeroflight episodes and stuff, my goal is to educate the industry. I feel... I'm going to throw a blanket statement out there, and I'm going to say I feel that the industry as a whole is more focused on making money
Agreed.
Than they are Preach. About giving the proper information. Agreed. And I think it's dangerous. If you're just a target archer, you're just out in the backyard having fun, there's really no ramifications of a bad arrow or a bad bow. But when you're out shooting at an animal, The only thing I hope that listeners get from my conversations, our conversations, is that they know what they're going into the field with. Do you want to shoot a heavy FOC arrow? Cool, that's great. Do you know what it does? Do you know how it performs? And are you okay with it? And if the answer is yes, 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 awesome. I wish you the most amount of success anyone could find. But just know what you're doing. And I feel like we have so little time on our hands as just a population right now, that it's easy to say, that bow shot fine last year, let me take it out. That arrow worked fine 2 years ago, let me take it out, you know? So my thing is just do a little research, find out, seek the information, and just figure out how things are performing. Because you might find out that the one or two flyers that you had, or that broadhead that didn't want to fly properly, or that arrow that didn't want to fly properly, it might not be a build thing. It might be one specific component. Maybe your arrows aren't indexed properly. They're not spine aligned properly. So now they're flexing in a different direction coming off the riser. So when it flexes off the riser in a different direction, it catches wind differently and it pushes the arrow into a different direction on launch. So if an arrow isn't launched facing the exact same way, how is it supposed to hit the exact same place that you shot the last one? You know, so it's just, George loves this saying, and the more I hear it, the more I keep wanting to say it. The more you learn and the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And I think that is what's so intriguing about this rabbit hole that I've dove down. And it's only one half. We spent most of this conversation talking about the arrows. And there's a whole other half of this that comes from the bow. Mm-hmm. Because again, you can build your arrow 110 different ways, but your bow is still delivering that energy. And if your bow is not delivering all of the energy it possibly can, well, the arrow is not going to magically make up its own or find energy in air. What you send it into, what you send it off launch with is what it's got. You know, so there's so much in this. But again, it's the education that really excites me.
I don't know, Chris. I don't think the industry is going to agree with you, because how can that be right if you're not using the best saddle hunting gear and grinding it on public land and only shooting a 675 grain arrow with a single bevel broadhead? That's the only way to do it, because that's what everybody talks about.
Yeah. And I've heard it, man, you know, and there's, you know, spineless arrows, right? Sounds pretty cool, but if your arrow was spineless, you'd have no possible way of controlling it and knowing which way it's going to go or move or how it's going to behave. Thin arrows, they sound great, but they have a thicker wall, so they're going to they're going to flex for a longer period of time, because the thicker something is, the more memory it has and the longer it takes to stop. These are things I never ever heard about until I started diving down the science rabbit hole. And once I heard about it, yeah, don't get me wrong, 166 arrows are sexy as hell. They look incredible. They're cool. They're sleek. They're the Ferrari of arrows. But do they behave the way you want? And if you're not getting the greatest arrow flight that you're looking for, I just urge you to do some research. That's all. And again, if you're comfortable with the way things are flying and behaving and performing and all that stuff, I'm so happy for you. And that's not sarcastic at all. But if you're not happy with it, or if you're just interested in checking out what's out there, just beware. It's addicting. You're going to spend days and days and days thinking and researching and talking, but it's all for the, in my opinion, it's all for the benefit of the animal. And whatever Mitch finds flies the best for him is what you should be going in the woods with, because confidence kills deer. Whatever I feel is the best is what I should be going in the woods with, because confidence kills deer. And if you go into the woods with something you don't believe in just because somebody else said it's the best thing out there, you're already at 50% capacity.
I love the way you said it, and I think that's a good way to put a pin in this one till the next time, because I've had you on before, and I feel like every time we barely scratch the surface when we get into the world of archery and bow hunting. And I, to be honest with you, when it gets into this conversation, you know, I've listened to a couple of the episodes that you've done in the world of arrow flight and stuff. Like, it's like trying to take a bite out of a 17-pound cheeseburger for me. Like, I don't know where to start. It's too much to process, and breaking it down incrementally is very tough. So one thing I would say is if you're interested in this conversation and you've never listened to any of the episodes that Chris has done in the world of arrow flight, he has broken down a lot of episodes himself and also with Dorge from Fire Knock, and kind of explained it way better. And you know, me selfishly, I just took things that I've kind of thought, and I just asked Chris's perspective, and he has done it for myself. Do that for yourself, but through the form of research and maybe listen to some of Chris's episodes and helping make those right decisions. So, Chris, this was fun. You know, your Wing and Tail Outdoors podcast, I believe. I think I have that right. Wing and Tails Outdoors. Mm-hmm. Everybody calls me the Pennsylvania Outdoorsman. It's the Pennsylvania Woodsman podcast, guys. Yeah. Not that it really matters. But no, you're on Instagram, Facebook, all that good stuff. And you yeah. build arrows for people if they reach out to you. Do you not?
Yeah, yeah. They're all custom built. They're built for you. They're built for your draw length, draw weight, what your application is. You know, if you're shooting at 30 yards max, I'm going to build you a different arrow than, you know, at 60 yards. But I appreciate the shout out and all that good stuff. And if you head on over to wingandtailoutdoors.com, there's a couple different pages on the science of arrow flight where there's a real shortened version of a lot of the sciencey stuff. I tried to make it as simple as possible. And then another page there that gives the information on the arrows I build. And if you have any questions or any interest, my contact is down there at the bottom as well. But my email is wingandtail.chris@gmail.com. And I'd be happy to talk to anyone. Even if you just have a question about arrows and you just want to learn more, I'd be happy to talk to you.
Love it, man. Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mitch. Till next time.